This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents In the Unlikely Event by Judy Bloom. Read for you by Kathleen McInerney. 35 years later, February 10th, 1987. Even now, she can't decide. She thinks about flipping a coin. Heads she goes, tails she stays. But isn't indecisiveness an early sign of mental illness? Didn't she cover a story about that a few years ago? Or is it that she's conflicted? Conflicted is better than indecisive. Why is she thinking this way? A voice inside her head says, "You know damn well why." She steps up to the bank of phones inside the departure lounge and dials her 15-year-old daughter Eliza at school, but gets her machine. She supposes it's good news that Eliza has gone to her early morning class. She'll try her again later when she gets there, if she goes. Otherwise, she'll call from home. She's still weighing the pros and cons an hour later when the flight to Newark is announced and the first-class passengers are invited to board. She feels the panic rising, the dry mouth, the pounding heart, the urge to run. The moment of truth. Once she gets on the plane, there will be no turning back. A hot flash washes over her body. "For God's sake, not now," she tells herself, wriggling out of her coat as sweat pools between her breasts. She takes a deep breath, grabs her carry-on bag, and heads for the gate. She's going to do this. She's not backing down. Once she's seated with her seatbelt fastened, she thinks about taking a Valium to help her sleep on the long flight. But when has she ever slept on a plane? The guy next to her in the window seat is already loosening his tie, slipping a sleep mask over his eyes. No chit-chat for him, which is fine with her. She's about to pull out the book she's reading, The Prince of Tides, but instead grabs the classy leather-covered journal her friend Christina gave her for her birthday. Each of them has been asked to share something tomorrow, a few personal words, a poem, a memory. This is her only entry. After enough time, it fades, and you're grateful. Not that it's ever completely gone. It's still there, buried deep, a part of you. The stench is gone from your nostrils now, unless someone leaves the kettle on to boil and forgets about it. The nightmares have tapered out. There are more pressing things to dream about, to worry over, to keep you awake at night. Aging parents, adolescent children, work, money, the state of the world. Life goes on, as our parents promised that winter. Life goes on if you're one of the lucky ones. But we're still part of a secret club, one we'd never willingly join, with members who have nothing in common except a time and a place. We'll always be connected by that winter. Anyone who tells you different is lying. Part 1, December 1951. Elizabeth Daily Post. Christmas Tree Dazzles. December 11th, UPI. The 82-foot Christmas tree at Rockefeller Center dazzled last evening as its 7,500 red, white, and green lights were flipped on in the traditional ceremony to inaugurate the season. An onlooking crowd of 2,000 holiday shoppers and homeward-bound office workers wrapped in winter coats for the chilly weather oohed and awed as the lights blazed on. The voices of the Rockefeller Center choristers filled the air with Christmas carols, and skaters twirled on the ice below. A nationwide audience shared the ceremony, which was televised for the first time on NBC's Kate Smith Show. Miss Smith highlighted the event with a rendition of Irving Berlin's White Christmas. The tree will be lighted every day from twilight to midnight until January 2nd. Chapter 1. Miri. Mary Ammerman and her best friend Natalie Osner were sprawled on their bellies on the thick, tweedy, wall-to-wall carpet of Natalie's den, waiting for the first-ever televised lighting of the famous Christmas tree. The den was Mary's favorite room in Natalie's house, not least because of the 17-inch zenith inside a pale wood cabinet, the biggest television Mary had ever seen. Her grandmother had a set, but it was small with rabbit ears, and sometimes the picture was snowy. The furniture in the Osner's den all matched, the beige sofas and club chairs arranged around a Danish modern coffee table with its neat stacks of magazines, Life, Look, Scientific American, National Geographic. A cloth bag with a wood handle holding Mrs. Osner's latest needlepoint project sat on one of the chairs. A complete set of the Encyclopedia Britannica took up three shelves of the bookcase, along with family photos, including one of Natalie at summer camp, in jodhpurs, atop a sleek black horse, holding her ribbons, and another of her little sister, Fern, perched on a pony. In one corner of the room was a game table with a chess set standing ready. Not that she and Natalie knew how to play, but Natalie's older brother, Steve, did, and sometimes he and Dr. Osner would play for hours. She and Natalie sang White Christmas along with Kate Smith, then oohed and aahed with the crowd, with the whole country, when the tree was lit, signaling the start of the holiday season. Later, Mary found out her mother had been there to see it live, one of the 2,000 spectators. Rusty told Mary she'd been pushed and shoved as the crowd pressed forward until she decided it wasn't worth the effort and left to catch her train to Elizabeth. She could see the tree any old day on her way home from work. For Mary, the real start of the holiday season was her mother's birthday. Mary was sure Rusty had felt robbed as a kid, having a birthday so close to Hanukkah, but Rusty assured her that no, she'd never minded having a holiday birthday. It made it more special. This year, Hanukkah fell at the same time as Christmas, something Mary thought should be the rule, not the exception. She vowed she wouldn't wait until the last minute to do her shopping, but here she was on Saturday, the day before her mother's birthday, on a mission that took her downtown to Nia's Lingerie, a shop on Broad Street. Neither she nor her second best friend, Suzanne Dietz, who smelled of Noxzema year-round and had the best skin of any girl in their crowd, had ever set foot in Nia's. Just the word lingerie was enough to send them into fits of laughter. It sounded like something Mrs. Osner would say in her southern drawl instead of underwear. Underwear was what Mary and Suzanne bought at Levy Brothers, one of two department stores on Broad Street. Underwear was white cotton, but lingerie was something else. Not that there was anything suggestive in Nia's windows, not a bra or girdle in sight, and nothing black. Navy blue was as close as it got. Still, who knew what they'd find inside? Mary had clipped an ad from the Daily Post. This season, give her nylon tricot by Vanity Fair. She wasn't sure about nylon tricot, but the ad from Nia's showed a half slip for $3.99, something her mother might appreciate since she'd been complaining about the worn-out elastic waistbands of hers. A single chime announced the opening of the door as Mary and Suzanne entered the shop. Inside, it was busy with holiday shoppers, but not overwhelming the way it would be at Levy's or Girk's, the other downtown department store. The shoppers, all women, talked in hushed voices. A small white Christmas tree with silver ribbons threaded through its branches, topped by a silver angel, sat on the display table. Satin bedroom slippers and delicate bed jackets in pale colors were arranged around the tree. Who wore bed jackets? Rusty had a woolly robe and two flannel nightgowns for winter, and a seersucker robe and a few cotton nightgowns for summer. Maybe movie stars who were served breakfast in bed wore bed jackets. But there were no movie stars in Elizabeth, New Jersey. None that Mary knew of, anyway. Even Mrs. Osner didn't have a bed jacket. If she did, it wasn't hanging in her closet, because Mary had been through that closet 100 times, ever since she and Natalie had become best friends 2 years ago. Mary and Suzanne were still babysitting partners and ate lunch at the same cafeteria table every day. They just weren't bests. "Can I help you?" a pretty young woman asked Mary. "Are you Nia?" Mary hadn't planned to say that. It just slipped out. "I'm Athena, her daughter. What can I show you today?" Athena. Mary didn't know anyone named Athena. Such an exotic name. Wasn't Athena the Greek goddess of wisdom, arts, and something else? Maybe war? She'd loved her book of Greek mythology in 5th grade. Uncle Henry had given it to her. Every night they'd taken turns reading myths to each other. "Are you looking for something special?" Athena asked. When Mary didn't answer, Suzanne nudged her. "It's my mother's birthday," Mary said, coming back to the moment. "And I was thinking of a half-slip, maybe a nylon tricot half-slip." Before Mary had the chance to dig the ad from her purse, Athena said, "I have just what you're looking for. What size does your mother wear?" "She's either a small or a medium, depending." "Really? A small?" Athena said, as if a mother couldn't possibly be a small. "She's 5'5", 115 pounds. Mary knew everything about her mother, every detail of her life, except for one, and she wasn't going to waste her time thinking of that today. Athena brought out a few half-slips. "Double slits," she said, holding up one. "By Vanity Fair, $3.99. "This is the nylon tricot. Feel how soft it is. It won't cause static." She laid a size small on top of the medium to show Mary the difference.
"My mother wears a medium," Suzanne said quietly,
as if she were giving away top-secret information.
"And she's bigger than your mom."
"Go with the small, then," Athena advised Mary. "She can exchange it if it's the wrong size."
"What color? We have it in white, pink, and navy." "She goes to business in New York," Mary said. "She wears dark colors, especially in winter. So I think navy."
"An excellent choice," Athena said. "Can I show you anything else?"
"I need to get her something for Hanukkah, but..."
"Hanukkah is like Christmas," Suzanne told Athena.
"Yes, of course," Athena said. Mary gave Suzanne a look. Why would she bother to explain? Not that Suzanne didn't pride herself on knowing all about the Jewish holidays. Not that she didn't love throwing around the Yiddish expressions she'd picked up from Mary's grandmother. Suzanne knew way more about the story of Hanukkah than Mary knew about Jesus.
"I can't spend as much this time," Mary told Athena.
Both she and Suzanne had saved their babysitting money for holiday shopping. They'd already chipped in to buy the little sisters they babysat a box of 5 finger puppets for $1.50. The girls were going to love them. But at this rate, Mary wasn't going to make it through her list.
"How about stockings?" Athena said.
"You can never have too many, especially when you go to business."
"But stockings are so boring." Mary turned to Suzanne. "Don't you think stockings are boring?"
"I don't know," Suzanne said. "I was thinking of getting my mother stockings for Christmas."
Mary backtracked.
"I didn't mean they're not a good idea."
Suzanne's mother was a nurse. She wore white stockings with her uniform. But Suzanne chose the new seamless stockings by Lily Dachet, 3 pair in Dubonnet Blonde, nicely packaged and tied with a red ribbon. Miri was thinking of a less practical gift, something that would make her mother laugh, something Rusty could show her friends at work, saying, "My daughter gave me this for Hanukkah. My daughter is such a card." When she was little, she'd always made something at school, a painted clay ashtray, a decorated coaster, a pin made of buttons. Rusty had saved every one of her handmade gifts. But now that she was a month from her 15th birthday, painted clay ashtrays were a thing of the past. Suzanne checked her mother's name off her neat, alphabetized list. Miri's list was in her head and was neither neat nor alphabetized. But at least she had a good birthday present for Rusty. At least she had that. "I hope you'll shop with us again," Athena said. "We will," Miri told her. Then she whispered to Suzanne, "The next time we need to buy lingerie," making Suzanne laugh as they opened the door and stepped out into the icy wind and blowing snow from yesterday's storm. Rusty. On Sayre Street, a brisk 15-minute walk from downtown in decent weather, a 10-minute bus ride on a day like today, Rusty Ammerman had already finished the laundry and vacuuming. The two-family house on a street of other two-family houses, each with a small, neat front yard, was divided into an upstairs apartment where she lived with Miri and a downstairs one where her mother, Irene, lived with Rusty's brother, Henry. But the doors between the two floors were never locked, and Miri spent as much time at Irene's as she did upstairs. Rusty was putting the finishing touches on the Hanukkah gift she was wrapping for Miri. The Land's nightgown was at the top of Miri's wish list, not that Miri had told her in so many words, but Rusty knew. All the girls had Land's nightgowns. She'd seen that in the photo from Natalie's slumber party, with four of them in Land's and Miri in ordinary pajamas. She hadn't planned on the white Angora mittens with leather palms, but she couldn't resist when she saw them in the window of Girk's last week on her way home from the train station. They certainly weren't practical, but Miri loved Angora. "The next best thing to having a pet," Miri said, since the dog or cat she wanted was out of the question. The house was too small. No one was home all day, and pets were a responsibility, not to mention an expense. Besides, Irene wouldn't hear of it. Rusty should know. She'd lobbied for a dog when she was a girl, when they'd lived on Westfield Avenue, in a single-family house with a backyard, close to her father's shop, Ammerman's Fine Food Emporium. She'd recruited Henry to beg with her. "We already have a cat at the store," her mother had said. "You can play with Schmaltzy any time you want to." What kind of name was Schmaltzy for a cat? Rusty's father had named him.
"Because he's fat," he'd explained. "Because he looks like he eats too much schmaltz."
Her mother used chicken fat, schmaltz, in the chopped liver she made every Friday.
"Schmaltzy catches mice," Rusty had said. "That's why he's fat." "That's his job," her father told her. "But he still likes to play."
"I want a different kind of cat," Rusty told him. "One who lives at home, or else a dog. A dog would be even better."
But then the market crashed, and in the depression that followed, a pet was the least of their concerns. Rusty hid the wrapped presents in the corner of her closet, on the highest shelf. Not that Miri would snoop around the way she had when she was little, but still, there was something satisfying about hiding them. Now that she'd finished her housework for the week, a little luxury was in order, starting with a long, hot bath. As the water ran in the clawfoot tub, Rusty chose her bath salts carefully, sniffing each one. Was she in a lavender mood? Vanilla? Musk? Yes, musk. Something to remind her. She was just turning 33. She was still young. It wasn't too late. She stepped into the steamy bath, then lowered herself, sinking lower and lower, until only her face was above water. Irene. Downstairs in her first-floor apartment, Rusty's mother, Irene Ammerman, poured a bottle of Harvey's Bristol Cream into a crystal decanter to welcome the holiday shoppers she hoped would flock to her house from 4 to 8 p.m., despite the falling temperatures. She'd sent out penny postcards inviting all her regular customers, encouraging them to bring friends. This morning, before he left for work at the newspaper, Henry had opened her dining room table to its full length, big enough to seat 12. She'd created a tabletop display with fluffy cotton, white as fresh snow, arranged the volupte compact just so, then scattered sparkly snowflakes around. The snowflakes would make a mess, she knew, and she'd be hoovering tomorrow morning. But they were worth it. This year's line featured a style to appeal to every taste. If you wanted gemstones, there were gemstones. If you preferred gold accents on silver, fine. And if you wanted simple but elegant, there were plenty to choose from. She set the Ronson lighters, the other line she carried, in small groups, ranging from large silver tabletop models to small, pocket-sized squares. There was still time to have the Ronsons engraved, but not much. She had to be careful what else she put on the table. Last year, she'd used her leaded crystal candlesticks to add height to her display, along with a few colorful antique bowls. A mistake, since customers assumed they were also for sale. So she sold a few bowls, making up prices on the spot. But the candlesticks? No. She didn't have much left from the old days, when they were flush from the store. And these she was keeping for Rusty, or Mary, or even Henry's wife, if he married, which she hoped he would. Yesterday, she'd splurged on a wash, set, and manicure at Connie's beauty salon. She needed to look as stylish as the gift she was hoping to sell. Presentation was presentation, and that included her. She moved the family photos, usually lined up on the sideboard, to the top of the spinet to make room for her famous coffee cakes. Her customers would expect a nosh. She touched her lips to Mary's photo and stood it next to one of Max, her husband, who died 2 weeks before Mary was born. Boom, 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 just like that. Rusty turned 18, Max died, Mary was born. She was 41 at the time, and in 1 month she'd become both a widow and a grandmother. Bad things happen in threes, her cousin Belle reminded her. But Irene couldn't say that Rusty having a baby at 18 was a bad thing, or maybe it was, given the circumstances, but the baby herself was not. The baby, Mary, was a precious gift, with her grandfather's high cheekbones and dimpled cheek. Not a beauty like Rusty, not yet, but growing into her looks. The eyes, she knew where they came from, but she kept that to herself. She hoped to God she would never again come face to face with the person responsible for those eyes. If she did, she didn't know what she might do. He'd better hope she wouldn't have a carving knife in her hand. If she kept thinking of him, she might need a nitro under her tongue. She brushed off her hands as if brushing away bad thoughts and poured herself a small glass of sherry. Rusty came downstairs to help at the open house. Irene looked smart in a simple gray wool dress with a white collar. She was at her most charming, chatting with her customers, offering a glass of sherry to the few husbands who'd accompanied their wives, and to the women, too. "It will warm you up," she told them. Was anyone better at this than her mother? Rusty didn't think so. Irene had once confided to Rusty she'd had the opportunity, when she was young, to marry into the family who'd started Volupte. But her parents thought Max Ammerman was a better catch. He was 15 years older and already established in business. If she'd married the Volupte boy, she'd be powdering her nose in the best clubs and restaurants instead of selling compacts wholesale from home. It was still early, but already it looked like Irene would get a good turnout. Rusty replenished the stock from Irene's closet, handled the cash and the occasional check, and was available for gift wrapping. When the phone rang, Rusty excused herself and picked it up.
Irene?
No, this is her daughter, Rusty.
Oh, Rusty, dear, I haven't seen you in ages. This is Estelle Sapphire from Bayonne. I can't get to Elizabeth tonight. I'm busy packing, leaving for Florida in the morning. But I was hoping Irene could put away 6 compacts for me. My husband will pick them up tomorrow on his way back from the airport. He's driving to Miami, but I'm flying.
Lucky Mrs. Sapphire, Rusty thought, to be escaping this weather. She wouldn't mind a trip to Florida, but she took her 2 weeks of vacation in the summer so she and Miri could spend time together down the shore.
Any special design? Rusty asked.
No, dear. Whatever Irene thinks.
Price range?
Mid. Really, I'm just taking them in case I meet someone, a good hairdresser, a pleasant maid, you know, as a way to say thank you. So much nicer than giving money.
Of course, Rusty said. I'll get them ready for you right now.
Thank you, Rusty. Please tell Irene I said hello.
I will.
Rusty was willing to bet the pleasant maid or the good hairdresser would prefer cash, but a gift was better than nothing.
Rusty, darling, Irene said, handing her 4 compacts and 2 Ronsons. Could you gift wrap these for Mrs. Delaney? Red ribbon.
Red ribbon was a code for Christmas, not Hanukkah, which would be blue ribbon. Rusty knew Mrs. Delaney's son, a good-looking guy who worked at the branch bank on Elmora Avenue. He always flirted with her. Sometimes she flirted back, just to keep up her skills, though she knew he was married with 4 children, not to mention Catholic. Steve. A few blocks down East Jersey Street from the Martin Building, where Steve Osner's father had his dental office, and you could get a great-tasting burger at 3 Brothers Luncheonette, Steve was shooting baskets at the YMHA with his best buddy, Phil Stein, both of them seniors at Thomas Jefferson High. They'd been born 2 weeks apart at Elizabeth General Hospital and bar mitzvahed a week apart at Temple B'nai Israel across the street from the Y. A couple of regulars were playing with them in a pickup game, and one of them must have brought Mason McKittrick. He seemed like a nice enough kid, not that Steve knew him well, since he was just a junior, but he had good moves and a great hook.
You should go out for the team next year, Steve told him. Bet you could make varsity.
I work after school, Mason said, at Edison Lanes. Not much time for practice.
You set up pins?
Yeah. That and other stuff when it gets busy.
I'll look for you next time we go bowling.
You in a league?
Nope, just bowl for fun.
Mason nodded. In the locker room, Steve asked Phil,
You want to grab a burger at 3 Brothers? I'm starving.
Nah, my mother's probably got dinner in the oven.
Okay, but come over later.
You have a plan?
Don't tell me you forgot already.
Remind me.
My sister's party.
We're going to your sister's party?
Steve swatted him with his damp towel.
I have to chaperone. My mother thinks if I'm around there won't be any trouble. What a joke. Remember 9th grade? That's the first time I copped a feel.
You were always ahead of the rest of us, Phil said.
If only that were still true, Steve thought. A lot of the guys talked about how much they were getting. Their girlfriends let them touch and look. Steve had touched, but no one had ever let him look. He didn't have a regular girlfriend. He liked playing the field. Maybe he just hadn't met the right girl yet.
He knew girls who'd invite you into their houses to neck on the sofa in the living room, but it never went any further than that. Maybe he was doing something wrong. It might be different if they went to a co-ed high school. Theirs was the only city in New Jersey with sex-segregated public high schools, Jefferson for boys, Baton for girls. Even St. Mary's was co-ed, and those kids were Catholic. "I'll set up a card table in the laundry room," he told Phil. "We'll play a little AC/DC. You in?"
"Why not?"
Phil said. Mason didn't say anything.
"You know what they do at their parties?"
Steve said.
"Who?"
Phil asked. "Geez, Phil, my sister and her friends. Who do you think?"
"No idea."
"They play rotation," Steve said. "The musical chairs of making out. That's a prelude to sex if ever there was one." It was one thing to make a joke of it with Phil, but if he ever found some guy messing around with his sister, he'd tear him to shreds. Not just Natalie, but Fern. The men of the family had to be vigilant. It was their job to protect the women. That's the way it was, whether the women liked it or not. The family's honor was at stake. No one told him this in so many words, but he understood what his mother expected of him, to be an honorable man. He was his mother's favorite, and he knew it. Natalie and Fern were more daddy's girls. He had 10 years before he had to worry about Fern. She was just in kindergarten. By then, he'd be, what, 27, almost 28? He'd probably be married, maybe with his own kids. Geez, that was a scary thought.
"So what time tonight?"
Phil asked Steve.
"Around 8. "I'll be there."
Phil turned to Mason.
"You want to ride home? I got the car outside."
"Yeah, sure," Mason said.
"I just have to pick up my dog. The janitor's watching him in the basement."
Steve had a car outside, too, but they were going in different directions. Mason. Phil took Mason home for supper, introduced him and his dog, Fred, to Phil's parents. Phil swore it would be okay, said his mother liked dogs, and it was true. She took to Fred right away, scratching him behind the ears like she knew what she was doing.
"Look at this little fellow. What a darling boy you are," she said to the dog, who cocked his head at her. "I miss my dog Goldie very much," she told Mason.
At the dinner table, Fred sat at Mrs. Stein's feet, looking up at her, hoping for scraps. There was no more talk of Goldie, and Mason didn't ask any questions. Phil's father was some big deal executive. He and Phil talked about football over the roast beef. They were New York Giants fans and had tickets for tomorrow's game, the last of the season, against the New York Yanks.
"Are you a fan, son?"
Phil's father asked Mason.
"Yes, sir,"
Mason answered.
"What team?"
Phil's father asked.
"Yours, sir, the New York Giants." "Atta boy,"
Phil's father said, clinking his fork against his glass. Mason preferred baseball to football, but he kept that to himself. He still couldn't believe Joe DiMaggio was retiring. After dinner, Phil asked Mason if he wanted to go to Steve's. When Mason hesitated, Mrs. Stein picked up Fred.
"It's too cold for such a sweet little fellow to be outside. He can spend the night here, and you can get him tomorrow."
Fred didn't complain, didn't even run to the door when Mason left with Phil. Natalie. The Osners' house was down Shelley Avenue, on the left, across the street from school number 21, where Natalie had gone to elementary school.
"I don't see why Steve needs to be a chaperone tonight," she was arguing with her mother in the upstairs hallway. "I mean, really, what do you think is going to happen? You know all these kids. I've been going to school with them since 7th grade. They've been here a million times." Boys can get rambunctious, especially this time of year, her mother said, her southern drawl more pronounced during an argument. The holiday season makes them crazy. I don't want any trouble. We have a responsibility to the other parents.
But it's not like you won't be home. You'll be in the den.
Steve will be unobtrusive.
I hope you know you're ruining my get-together. I hope you know that.
You won't even know he's there. He'll be in the laundry room.
The laundry room?
This almost made Natalie laugh. The laundry room was next to the finished basement, and almost as big.
With some of his friends.
His friends? I don't want his friends anywhere near my get-together.
I just told you. You won't even know they're there.
I'll know. I just hope my friends don't find out. If Daddy were here, he'd understand.
I'm sure your father would agree with me.
I doubt it. And keep Fern upstairs, please. All I need is Fern walking around with her cowboy bunny. It's hard enough to be 15 without your family making it worse.
You're not 15 yet, Natalie Grace Osner.
But I will be soon, unless I die of humiliation first. Just before the party began, Natalie confronted Steve in the laundry room, where he was setting up a card table.
Just stay out of our way. Don't ruin my get-together with your wisecracks.
I'll bet your girlfriends wouldn't mind. They like my wisecracks.
Stay away from my girlfriends.
Steve laughed.
As if I'm interested.
You're just 3 years older than me, Big Shot. Remember that. Your wife will probably be younger than I am. The girl you're going to marry is probably Fern's age now.
Gee, I wonder if she has a toy rabbit.
If Natalie had had a bottle of soda in her hand, she'd have shaken it and squirted it in Steve's face. But she didn't, so she couldn't. Ruby. In Sunnyside, Queens, Ruby Granick was giving herself a facial, massaging gray clay into her delicate skin. Her hair was wrapped in a towel. She was careful not to let the clay drop onto her chenille robe, as warm and comfy as a childhood blankie. Her suitcase sat open on her bed, a pale pink cardigan sweater with pearl buttons thrown on top. Her family was going to celebrate Christmas tonight, 10 days early, because she was leaving tomorrow morning on her way to Miami to dance at the Vagabond Club on Biscayne Boulevard. She'd just appeared at Cafe Society in New York, though she was still waiting for her check on that one. All in all, not bad for a local girl. Her gifts for her mother and father were wrapped. She just needed to tie them with ribbon. For her mother, the same pink cardigan with pearl buttons as the one in her suitcase, but in a larger size. Her mother loved wearing the same things as Ruby. Something about being a twin, Ruby thought. When she was little, her mother made them mother-daughter dresses. But the day she'd turned 10, Ruby had balked.
I'm not your twin.
I know that, Ruby. You're my daughter.
I don't want to wear the same clothes as you.
Well, if that's the way you feel, you don't have to.
You and Aunt Emmy can wear the same clothes. You're twins.
Yes, we are, but we're grown-up twins now, and we only wear the same clothes if we're going to a family party. Even that struck Ruby as strange, but as long as she didn't have to wear matching dresses anymore, she was satisfied. Funny, because now that she'd grown up herself, she didn't mind, from time to time, buying two of something, since her mother's life was difficult, and it gave her so much pleasure. For her father, she'd found a large magnifying glass in a leather case. Her father was confined to a wheelchair since his foot was amputated in August, a complication of diabetes. Now, with his failing eyesight, another complication, her mother had had to quit her job to stay at home and take care of him. These days, Ruby was their sole support. Not that she brought in much, even when she had a steady job,
but she was sure that was about to change. She felt a twinge of guilt for leaving her parents over the holidays, but she had a career to think about. Her aunt was coming from New Jersey, from Elizabeth, where she and her mother had grown up singing in the church choir. The singing Konecki twins, Emmy and Wendy. At least she wouldn't be leaving her parents completely alone. Her mother and father could argue about anything and everything, and having Aunt Emmy in the house would help. Her father liked Emmy. He called her the reasonable twin, which sometimes infuriated her mother, and other times made her laugh. From downstairs, she heard her mother call,
"Ruby, do you need me to iron your white blouse?"
"Thanks, Mom, but I'll do it later. I have a few other things to press."
"I don't mind. Bring them down."
Ruby gathered a pair of shorts, two skirts, and an off-the-shoulder blouse. She ran down the stairs with them, just as the doorbell rang. She pulled the door open, expecting to see Aunt Emmy. Instead, it was Dana, Ruby's best friend, another long-legged dancer. Dana burst out laughing.
"You look cute," she said, reminding Ruby her face was still covered in gray clay.
"Dana, you're frozen,"
Ruby's mother said, greeting her daughter's friend.
"A cup of coffee or tea?"
"Thanks," Dana said, "but I'm okay." Dana followed Ruby up the stairs. They'd met and roomed together on the national tour of Kiss Me, Kate. Ruby wasn't sure she'd ever have that much fun again.
"Looks like you're all packed," Dana said.
"Almost. I was just finishing wrapping presents for my mom and dad."
"Give me the ribbon. I'll do it. You get that goo off your face. I can't take you out for a holiday drink like that."
"We're going out for drinks?"
"We are."
Ruby passed the red and green ribbon to Dana. "Give me 10 minutes, so long as I'm back for supper with the family. You should stay. My mother's making pierogi."
"I love your mother's pierogi."
"She'll be happy to have another guest. Aunt Emmy's driving in from Elizabeth."
"With handsome Uncle Victor?"
"Afraid the handsome fireman has to stay at home. He's on duty. Anyway, he's old enough to be your father."
"I like older men."
"My uncle is off limits."
"As if I don't know."
They laughed as they walked arm in arm to Billy's, the tavern on the corner, where they sat in a booth. Ruby's skin was glowing from the facial. Without makeup, she could pass for a high school student.
"What can I bring you, lovely ladies?" Billy asked.
Billy was bald, short, and round, but he moved fast.
"Two hot toddies," Dana said. "With pleasure, though neither one of you beauties looks old enough to be legal."
He knew they were. Billy had known Ruby's family since before she was born, knew she'd turned 22 over the summer, just before her father's surgery. Billy knew almost everything about her family, and he kept it to himself. When they were served, Dana held up her glass.
"Cheers! Here's to a great year for both of us."
Ruby clinked glasses with her.
"I'll second that."
They talked for 45 minutes over a second hot toddy, taking turns feeding nickels into the jukebox. When they tired of holiday songs, they started on Broadway musicals, singing along with "Why Can't You Behave?", reminding them of their good times on the road, and entertaining the few customers who were seated at the bar. When it was time to leave, Billy called,
"Have a good trip, Ruby."
"Thanks, Billy. And don't let my father have more than one, if anyone brings him in."
"Don't worry, sweetheart. And a Merry Christmas to you."
"You too, Billy."
Miri. That night, Suzanne's father dropped Miri and Suzanne at Natalie's house. Mrs. Osner answered the door. Small and pretty, she wore a single strand of pearls, whether she was in a skirt and sweater, like tonight, or a cocktail dress on her way to the country club. Miri liked to think of her as Corinne. She liked thinking of all the adults in her life by their first names. It made them seem more interesting,
less like parents and more like regular people with stories of their own. Steve and Fern were dark-haired like Dr. Osner, but Natalie was dirty blonde with short, soft curls like her mother and the same gray-blue eyes. Even though Natalie's family was Jewish and attended Temple B'nai Israel on the high holidays, same as Miri's family, they had a big, beautiful tree in their living room, which they called a Hanukkah bush. It was decorated with handmade wooden animal ornaments. On Christmas Eve, Natalie and Fern would hang up stockings by the fireplace, and Fern would leave out milk and cookies for the Jewish Santa, who flew through the sky wearing a blue suit with silver Jewish stars. Instead of reindeer, his cart was pulled by camels, because he came from Israel, not the North Pole. Dr. Osner didn't approve of celebrating this way, but Mrs. Osner, who came from Birmingham, Alabama, had grown up with the custom and refused to give it up. Miri wished her family celebrated the Jewish Santa, too. She would have enjoyed decorating a tree and leaving milk and cookies for him, even though she was way too old to believe. "The young people are downstairs," Corinne told Miri and Suzanne, as if they didn't know. Natalie wasn't the only one in their crowd to have a finished basement, but if they put it to a vote, Natalie's would win by a mile. It wasn't just the red leather banquettes, the knotty pine walls, the red and black floor tiles, or even the oval bar with its flip-top counter and glasses in every size imaginable lined up neatly on mirrored shelves. Forget all that. What made Natalie's basement take the prize was the jukebox. "It's not new," Natalie always said, as if it would be a crime to have your own new jukebox, the kind with swirling colors and flashing lights. Natalie still got to change the records herself, and nobody had to put in a coin to start it up. You just had to push the button. Dr. Osner brought home the jukebox with all the latest hits, thanks to one of his patients who was in the music business. "Some gangster," Natalie once confided to Miri. When Natalie pushed the button and the jukebox came to life, the dancing began with something swingy, something they could Lindy to. "Hey, good lookin', what you got cookin'?" It left them laughing, breathing hard, ready for more. But when Nat King Cole came on singing Nature Boy, the mood shifted. Miri was wondering who she'd dance the first slow dance with, when out of nowhere, a dark-haired boy, someone Miri had never seen before, came up to her, wrapped his arms around her, and held her close, as if they'd been dancing together forever. Well, swaying was more like it, but even so, there was a boy, a very strange, enchanted boy. She could feel the pack of Luckies in his shirt pocket. She didn't know they were Luckies, but she imagined they were. She wondered what he felt holding her that way, and hoped it wasn't her hidden treasure bra. "Give a girl a Peter Pan and she will grow, grow, grow." Not likely Nat King Cole would record that one. She had to stop herself from talking, from asking questions the way she did when she was nervous, because she sensed this boy didn't want to talk. She prayed the palms of her hands wouldn't sweat, that her deodorant was working, that the faint scent of her mother's arpège would reach his nostrils. His breath was near her ear, making her tingle. Then the song ended, and he was gone, like Cinderella racing from the ball, but without a shoe, glass or otherwise, left behind to help her find him. She didn't even know his name. She doubted he knew hers, either. She hoped her blue Angora sweater, the one she kept in a garment bag on the top shelf of the fridge, had shed just enough onto his flannel shirt to remind him of her. When someone turned out the lights, Miri snuck away and headed upstairs to Natalie's bedroom. She wasn't in the mood for playing rotation after dancing with the sexy stranger. Upstairs, she lay on one of Natalie's twin beds, the bed she slept in almost every Saturday night. But not tonight, because tomorrow was her mother's birthday, and she needed to be home to bring her breakfast in bed, a tradition started 3 years ago, when permission to use the stove was finally granted. Miri liked to pretend this was her room. The starched organdy skirt on the dressing table was as pretty as any summer dress. Attach a couple of straps, and she could wear it to the ninth grade prom in June. She knew that inside the dresser lay piles of cashmere sweaters. Miri had once counted them. 14. Natalie was embarrassed.
We get them at a discount from the cashmere sweater lady. You should come over next time she's here.
As if Miri could afford to buy cashmere sweaters, even at a discount. More than once, Miri had allowed herself to fantasize being a part of Natalie's perfect family. If Natalie's mother died, not a gruesome slow death, but something fast and dramatic, say a car crash, Natalie's father could marry Miri's mother, who was young and beautiful and single. Then Miri and her mother and grandmother could move into Natalie's big red brick house, and Miri and Natalie would be sisters, and Miri could start collecting cashmere sweaters like Natalie. Not that Miri didn't like Natalie's mother. Mrs. Osner, Corinne, had always been very nice to her. She treated Miri almost like another daughter, which was just one reason this fantasy left Miri feeling ashamed and sick to her stomach. She didn't want to be a disgusting and immoral person. Fern suddenly appeared in the doorway to Natalie's room, clutching a toy rabbit dressed in cowboy gear. Fern called him Roy, for Roy Rogers, the singing movie cowboy. Fern was obsessed with Roy Rogers.
Oh, give me land, lots of land under starry skies above. Don't fence me in, she sang.
Fern was wearing flowered flannel pajamas with feet.
Is the party over yet? She asked.
No, Miri said.
Does Mrs. Barnes know you're running around?
Mrs. Barnes took care of Fern and cooked dinner for the family 4 nights a week. She made dishes Miri had never heard of, dishes with foreign names like bœuf bourguignon and veal marsala. They tasted better than they sounded.
She's not here tonight, Fern said. Mommy and Daddy are here. They're in the den.
Oh.
Roy Rogers has a penis, Fern said, waggling Roy Rabbit in Miri's face. Did you know that?
Yes, Miri said.
She'd heard it often enough, every time she was at Natalie's house. But she still wasn't sure how she was supposed to respond. Fern was just in kindergarten.
I've seen 2 penises, Fern said. Daddy's and Steve's.
Miri hadn't seen any penises, and she wasn't in a hurry to, either.
How about I tuck you into bed? She said to Fern. Okay.
Miri followed Fern down the hallway to her room, the beige carpet plush under their feet. Fern climbed into bed, and Miri pulled the blankets up to her chin.
Roy Rabbit doesn't have a penis, even though he's a boy bunny.
Miri wanted to get out of there. She'd had enough penis talk.
Don't forget to kiss me, Fern said.
Miri dropped a kiss on Fern's forehead. Her skin was cool and smelled sweet. She returned to the party just as it was breaking up.
Where were you?
Natalie asked.
Upstairs. I had a headache. I guess I fell asleep. Are you better now?
Miri nodded.
Who was that boy I was dancing with?
What boy?
That boy with the dark hair.
I didn't notice. Maybe one of Steve's friends. He had a card game going in the laundry room, and he was supposed to keep his friends away from my party.
Mason. Steve was pissed about him dancing with that girl.
She's my sister's best friend, asshole, so stay away from her. I didn't even invite you here.
Hey,
Phil said to Steve,
take it easy. I invited him.
I didn't know we weren't supposed to dance, Mason said. Nobody told me.
We're chaperones, Steve told him. You know what that means? Or don't they teach you that in junior year?
Okay, Steve, Phil said, standing between him and Mason. We get it. Off limits. It's your house. You get to set the rules.
Too late, Mason realized it had been a mistake to come to Steve's house, so he hightailed it up the stairs. In the kitchen, Dr. Osner was scooping Breyer's ice cream into two bowls.
Everything all right?
Dr. Osner asked.
Yes, sir, Mason answered. Everything is fine.
He hoped Dr. Osner wouldn't recognize him from that day his brother had dragged him to his office, his face swollen with a toothache. His brother's girlfriend worked for Dr. Osner, but no one was supposed to know they were going together. Something about Christina's family being Greek and Jack's being Irish. Their secret was safe with him. He had plenty of secrets, and he kept them all to himself. He grabbed his jacket and was out of there, glad his dog was spending the night at Phil's house. What really bothered him was that he didn't know he was doing anything wrong when he danced with that girl. He'd caught a glimpse of her doing the Lindy with some boy who barely came up to her chin, and he'd liked the way she looked, liked the dimple in her cheek when she smiled, the long hair flying. He just got a feeling that it would be nice to hold her. When he did, she didn't talk, didn't say a word, and neither did he. Just the music and the feel of her in his arms. Yeah, that was all. She didn't flirt, didn't play games, just moved with him. Just that. Miri. Suzanne was spending the night at Robo's house on Byron Avenue, so Natalie's father drove Miri home. Miri was sure when Mr. and Mrs. Boros named their daughter Roberta, they never expected her to be called Robo. She enjoyed having Dr. O to herself.
What's new and exciting, Miss Mirabelle?
He had a special name for her, but when it came to new and exciting, she couldn't tell him about the mystery boy, so she didn't say anything.
Still working on the school paper?
Dr. O asked, and he seemed really interested.
Yes, but we never get to cover any exciting stories. Just the same old Christmas pageant and the annual food drive.
Say you were interviewing me, he said. What would you ask?
I'd ask what made you become a dentist.
He laughed.
Really? You're interested in teeth?
I'm interested in people.
That's what I like about being a dentist, he said. My patients.
Miri was his patient. So was the rest of her family.
Were you always checking your friend's teeth when you were young, saying, open wide?
He laughed again.
I was more interested in music. But my brothers were dentists. They encouraged me to go to dental school. We practiced together for a while.
Where are they now?
He hesitated.
They moved away.
Do you miss them?
Yes, I do.
They pulled up to Miri's house.
Thanks for the ride, she called, getting out of the car.
My pleasure, Miss Mirabelle.
Dr. O was everyone's favorite, which is why Miri couldn't help wishing she had a father just like him. Somewhere, Miri had a father, but she didn't know where. What kind of guy leaves his 17-year-old pregnant girlfriend and never even sees his baby? She'd asked Rusty more than once when she was little,
"Where is my daddy? Who is my daddy?"
She could tell, even then, Rusty wasn't going to answer that question.
Elizabeth Daily Post. Joy to the World. December 15th. The blanket of snow dumped on Elizabeth over the past 2 days seems not to have deterred bundle-laden shoppers. With Christmas lights strung across streets, stores gaily decorated for the season, and the ever-present sound of carols, shoppers seemed bent on proving they could have a good time no matter what the weather. Leaving their cars behind because of dangerous driving conditions, they waited last night for buses downtown on Broad Street, contributing to the heavy burden already placed on public transportation during and after Friday's snowstorm. "It's Christmas," said Myrtle Carter.